Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And now on to that investigative report on the results of a no-bid Halliburton contract for an oil pipeline repair in Iraq. After the project ate up more than $75 million, it was abandoned, and critics say despite the company keeping the money, there was never any hope of it actually being finished. And the penalty for this was what the New York Times called a mere slap on the wrist. With me now to talk about his report is James Gland, a correspondent with the New York Times. Welcome to WNYC, James. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
First of all, what was this pipeline project at the banks of the Tigris River?
Well, it was a crucial pipeline crossing because in Iraq, the rich northern oil fields are in the north, but to the east near Kirkuk. And in order to get that oil to export in Turkey and to the refineries north of Baghdad, you have to cross the Tigris. And so this was a crucial crossing to bring that oil across the Tigris.
And how much money was this pipeline project supposed to generate?
It was estimated by the Inspector General organization that looked at this project that it was losing, that Iraq was losing $5 million a day because it was not operating properly. So that gives you an idea.
And KBR, the Halliburton subsidiary, was paid $75.7 million by the U.S. government for this contract. Maybe it's useful to go back and talk a little bit about this idea of no-bid contract. What does that mean, and how is the price actually set?
Well, there was a contract awarded by the Army to Halliburton in March 2003, basically in secrecy as the war plans move forward. That was a contract to restore Iraqi oil infrastructure. Remember in the first Gulf War, Saddam set all the oil wells in Kuwait afire. And so the U.S. was sort of expecting he might do the same thing in Iraq, so it wanted to be prepared. It chose Halliburton as the company that would come in, put out those oil well fires it expected, and then sort of move on. That never happened, but because it was seen to be so urgent by the U.S. and because the Army was so comfortable working with Halliburton, they awarded that contract without a bidding process.
Your report talks about warnings that the company got before they started work, warnings that it would be very difficult or even impossible to actually succeed at this. Who warned what of whom? Who warned whom of what, I mean?
Right. Well, who knew what when, right?
Or maybe of whom. Who knows?
Well, it's all about geology in that case. The someone in KBR did the right thing and ordered a really basic geological study done of that area. There was a bridge there in place. Of course, that's what the pipelines went over on before the war, before the United States bombed that bridge in the invasion. And when that bridge was put up, I think in the 1980s, core samples were taken of the ground and put on record, as they always are. And so there was some geological information available just on record. And someone in KBR commissioned a study based on that information, and the information came back that you better be careful because it's very complicated geological area. You might not find what you think you're going to find once you start drilling under the Tigris River there. Don't go ahead until you do further extensive tests. And that warning was one of several that was ignored by the company, but also by the Army Corps of Engineers, which was managing the whole thing.
Why would they ignore their own report?
That's, I guess, the $75 million question. We really don't know why they didn't take that to heart and do the testing. The company, in its response to questions on this, said that they thought it would be too complicated to do that testing. They did special equipment they didn't have in Iraq. And second, they felt that the information in the geological report was too general and that they weren't really sure that it constituted a warning at the time.
The implication here, though you don't quite say this, is that they went ahead with something that they thought had a high likelihood of failure because they were getting this contract and it was an easy contract to get and it was very lucrative, and they didn't really care whether it succeeded as long as they were getting that $75 million.
Well, in the report in the paper, we don't really try to attribute motive because we don't really know what that motive was. When we came back and asked the company questions about it, they really tried to justify their actions and said that the warnings weren't strong enough and it would have been too hard to do the testing. Now, some of the people we talked to, you know, tried to do a little bit of psychologizing, you might say, on the company, and some people just thought they were confused, the company was confused. Other people thought maybe they did think they had a good deal and decided to plow ahead. We don't really know what the answer to that question is.
Would you call this a scandal or just a failed pipeline project?
Well, I spent a long time reporting this project. I've actually gone up to that spot when I'm in Iraq. Occasionally I can travel to the north, and I've stood on that horrible spot. It's a depressing place. The bridge is still sitting there charred and broken, surrounded by these sort of badland-looking hills, like layer cakes gone bad kind of thing. And you can see where it sort of looks like the kind of place where nothing's going to go right. And you have to take into account the difficulty of working in that environment because they were getting mortared all day long, and there's the normal confusion of working in Iraq. But having said that, I have to say that after I've done this reporting, I just think that this goes beyond mere sort of bad workmanship to the point where I think the company and the Army has to really ask some hard questions about how it could have gone that far when the project was going that badly.
Well, my guest on WNYC is James Glanz, correspondent with the New York Times, who's reported on this no-bid Halliburton contract that did not result in a crucial repaired pipeline in Iraq, despite $75 million of U.S. tax money going into it. And we can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, of course, your reporting focuses on this failure, but it was $75 million out of an overall $4 billion contract. And I don't know how the rest of it turned out, but it's relatively, I hate to call $75 million a drop in the bucket, but before we label the entire thing a failure, it's a very small percentage of the total money that was being spent on pipeline repair.
Right. It was actually $2.4 billion for this particular no-bid contract. It was, when it was awarded, it had a maximum number of $7 billion, and that number was cited for a while. They used $2.4 billion of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this particular job was inside of what's called a task order of $220 million of related work. But as you say, you could say $75 million a drop in the bucket. But I think what makes this project unique is not just what happened there. It's that we rarely get such a clear window into work in Iraq. For various reasons, we can't travel very easily there. The information is managed very carefully by the military and by the prime contractors like KBR. In this case, there was effectively a whistleblower who went to this office of the Special Inspector General. It's called for Iraq Reconstruction.
Now, we have to take a break. We'll look more deeply into that window, including hearing more about that whistleblower in just a minute with James Glanz from The Times. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times investigative reporter James Glanz. He's been reporting this week. Maybe you've seen some of the articles or the editorial in yesterday's Times on this no-bid contract for the Halliburton subsidiary KBR and the $75 million that got spent on what was supposed to be a crucial oil pipeline repair to help Iraq pay for its own reconstruction, as we heard would be the case before the war. But this pipeline project, this no-bid contract project, failed, and we're hearing why and all about it with James Glanz. Our phone number is 212-433-WNYC if you have any questions about this case and what it means, 212-433-9692. And James, just before the news, you were talking about this whistleblower. Tell us more.
Well, at one point, as the project really started to go south, so to speak, the Army Corps did send in a geologist, a fellow named Bob Sanders, who's already in his late mid-60s, a real curmudgeon of a fella, showed up and found that report that we mentioned that had warned way back at the beginning of the project that testing should take place before the project went forward. And then he went to the site, and as a geologist, he immediately saw what the problem was. it was a fault zone, and that's a place where two chunks of the Earth's crust have moved relative to one another and sort of torn up all the underground terrain. So instead of getting nice, solid, sedimentary rock that you can drill a hole through and that will maintain itself when you drill a hole through, it was sort of all cobblestones and jagged boulders and voids and things that would shift and break the drill bits off and cause all kinds of problems with drilling. And as he said in the piece, in his view, no driller in his right mind would try to drill through that terrain.
How much are the Army Corps of Engineers officials you spoke to defending KBR's actions?
It depends on whom you talk to, really. I think at the level of, so the operational level, you know, senior officers and civilian officials, but not the most senior commanders, I think there's a realization that something went wrong and a feeling that while many of them did their best and tried to sound warnings, it didn't work out the way it should have, a recognition that they need to learn something from this. I think at the highest levels in the Army Corps of Command, you know, there's a real issue as to how willing they are to bring a company like KBR to heel, and when things go wrong, how willing they are to see that disciplinary action is taken if it's called for. And that's I think that's one of the questions that the piece raises.
The U.S. Inspector General did issue a report earlier this year, as you report, on the project, and they criticized the company for not relaying the problems. But the penalty for KBR you describe as a slap on the wrist. What was the penalty?
It's a strange contract that they got. I guess in the world of big contracting, this occurs, but to most of us, I guess it would seem a little strange. It's called a cost-plus contract, and that means that you simply submit your costs, and virtually all of those are reimbursed sort of automatically. And then on top of that, you do have an evaluation that takes place. How well did you do that work? And then if you get and then you get a range of bonus fees, possible bonus fees. Those bonus fees were reduced for KBR down to something like 4% of what they could have won in this case, and that's what we call a slap on the wrist in the piece.
You call the you report that an official from the Inspector General's office told you it was a horrible contract. So he was commenting on the contract itself. How come?
Yeah, what he was talking about was the subcontract. This gets a little technical, but it's an important point. The subcontract KBR wrote for the actual drill teams. So KBR set the whole project up, and then they found a company in Texas, two companies actually, that specialize in this kind of drilling. They brought them over to Iraq, and then they wrote the subcontract. They said, well, you do this work for us, and here are the terms. We're KBR, and we're going to be paid by the Army Corps. We'll pay you. But when they wrote the contract for these companies, they did an odd thing. First of all, the companies, of all the people involved here, those drill companies actually did see the geologist report. And so they knew they could run into problems. And the outcome of that was they got a contract that said, come over and drill holes, but we aren't going to penalize you if the holes aren't actually completed. All you have to do is basically come out and drill every day. There were no incentives for success, and there were no penalties for failure in that contract. And that's what the person in the article was commenting on.
Now, that was an official from the Inspector General's office talking to you anonymously, I think. Was the report from his office on the record as damning as his comments off the record?
Or
without his name attached, I should say, because they weren't off the record.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. The report that they did was an on-the-record report. It's on their website. You can read it. It won't have all the detail that we have in the piece because of the way they write these things, a little bureaucratic and so on, but mm-hmm. It's actually a pretty good report. Again, mm-hmm. It's the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. That office is headed by a person named Stuart Bowen, who's done a wonderful job. The particular comment that you're referring to, it's an official in the office there who asked that his name not be used, but he's on the record. He's an official in the Inspector General's office, and he's commenting in the same vein as the report itself mm-hmm. on that particular issue.
James Glanz, my guest on WNYC. Maybe you've been reading his stories in the New York Times this week and earlier about the no-bid Halliburton contract that resulted in $75 million from the U.S. taxpayers' pockets going to a pipeline repair project that was considered crucial to get the reconstruction money flowing from Iraq to be used for Iraq, but that failed, and you've been hearing some of the ramifications and some of the reasons that James has reported on. Let's take a few phone calls. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and Josh in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Josh.
Hi, good morning. I turned on the radio this morning and started listening to your conversation, and I just get this sort of sick feeling of familiarity of no-bid contracts and Halliburton and KBR and projects with enormous, enormous budgets that ended up not going anywhere. At what point does this become, you know, and does the pattern become the problem and not the details of this particular incident?
James?
Well, it's hard to say because we don't have as clear a view into every project as we got in this particular case, but we do argue in this piece that it's a bit of a metaphor for the wider effort and for several reasons. But I think the main conclusion that we drew, and maybe the main point that addresses the reader's question or the caller's question, is that often the security situation in Iraq is blamed for projects going bad, and certainly it's hard to work in this environment. But what we found here was that simple bad decisions in a real basic managerial sense played as big a role as security in this case. And we sort of sense that the security card is played too often and that they ought to look more closely at how they actually carry out these projects, whether they work not just in Iraq but in downstate Illinois or any place else, given the way that they're carrying them out. That's a question we raise in the piece.
And when we talk about no-bid contracts in general, I mean, the whole term has a ring of, you know, something a little under the table or something a little unclean to it. That the usual defense of no-bid contracts is that they're only awarded in cases where there's only one company that really has the expertise or the capacity to pull it off. Maybe you could talk about that in general. Why any no-bid contracts? And, you know, is Halliburton getting special favors because they're specially connected, as some people would suspect? Or is it all on the up and up because they're the only ones who can do things like this, and this is how these things work?
Right. Well, of course, what sparked a lot of the early criticism of this when the no-bid contract became known was that before Dick Cheney became vice president, he was the CEO of Halliburton. So that's the source of the much of the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer that question as to whether that's playing a role. We bring it up regularly in pieces because that's what critics focus on.
And but it's not just that, and certainly that's, you know, that's a stark fact out there that that's relevant to any discussion. But Halliburton was getting a lot of no-bid contracts, or at least some, even during the Clinton administration, you know, before Dick Cheney came into office, when he was with Halliburton. And, you know, it's one of those companies that's always played the political game and it's been very connected. So it's not just that their former CEO came into the White House.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I think it's important to note is that this particular no-bid contract, the one that we've been discussing, was given for the work in Iraq, has put the kibosh on some of that kind of dealing in the military because they just took so much criticism for this instance. But, the justification is partly that the company is specially qualified for this kind of work, but also because the work may be considered especially urgent, you know, as it was going into the Gulf War. And so there's no time to go through a regular competitive bidding process. But I think what people have learned is that you're better off doing it the right way, doing it the careful way, except in cases of extraordinary need and urgency. And that it may be that this card is played, this no-bid card is played too often by the military. And whether it's because of political connections or what have you, I can't say. The outcome of it is often that it looks very bad, and if things go wrong, then people will point to that as one of the reasons.
Dorothy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dorothy.
Hello. I do think that you've sort of covered the area in a sense that of what I was thinking about. But some while ago, there was this woman who was in a government overseeing office. She got in a lot of trouble for criticizing the no-bid process. And I think ultimately she was either demoted as a whistleblower or something. She was a long-term civil service Washington black American woman. Her name was Bentadine or Bentadine something or other. And I was wondering if this was, in a sense, related to this current issue.
That's Bunnatine is the name, shortened Bunny. I haven't followed that story all that closely, and I'm a little fuzzy on the details. But you are right. She was a whistleblower. It's a controversial case. She brought problems forward, and in murky circumstances, was demoted. Now I don't want to say too much more about that because not having covered it in detail, I can't really tell you the outcome of that case or the full meaning of it.
James Glantz, my guest on WNYC, New York Times correspondent, who's been writing about this failed no-bid oil pipeline reconstruction contract to Halliburton in Iraq, and David in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Hello. It seems to me that another very important element in the larger significance of Mr. Glantz's story concerns really the press coverage of Iraq, because the defenders of the Iraq war are constantly accusing the press of reporting only the bad news about combat, about massacres, about the security situation, about militias. And they deplore the lack of attention to the beneficent rebuilding work, such as building schools, extending utilities, restoring other infrastructure for what they call the benefit of the Iraqi people. And, well, from this report, it sounds like maybe these aren't going so well either.
Well, in fact, you used the phrase earlier, James, that this is a metaphor for the wider effort.
Right. First, I want to preface my comments by saying that I'm in awe of the bravery and the good training and the work that the American military does abroad. And I spent a fair amount of time with the American military. Often, they're protecting me while I'm spending that time with them. Now, on this particular issue of whether we're reporting the good news, the military and the U.S. government doesn't get much of a hearing, I guess, in these quarters on that point, because we try to report what we see. We go out and we also risk our lives to do that reporting, and we're perfectly happy to report good news when we find it. What often happens in Iraq is that a press release will come out touting a project and basically singing its praises and the benefits it will have for the Iraqi people, and then you won't be able to get up there for one reason or another, and you're sort of stuck. But once you do, what you often find, as you do anywhere, the press release isn't quite what the project isn't quite what it was cracked up to be, according to the press release. They're not as good as they're made out to be, and the projects often don't live up to their billing. And this is a case where, basically, if you had asked the military, let's say yesterday, how's the project going at Al-Fatah, that's that pipeline crossing, they have a follow-on project that's almost finished, and they would have said, well, that's a success. We're just about done with that project. But you wouldn't have known the backdrop to this whole thing unless you'd gone in and dug into the project, which we did. Once you do that, you find out, as with so many things in Iraq, actually the news is much worse than you're led to believe, not much better.
So this project, though, did actually get or is on the road to successful completion? I mean, the background is you describe it as such a crucial crossroads of a pipeline for getting serious oil production generated again in Iraq. It is now on the road to completion?
Well, I have to make a qualified statement on that. Three years after it began, something like that, a follow-on project, which is taking much of another $66 million with using a different technique to get the pipelines across.
And using Halliburton or KBR?
No, it's a different contractor, Parsons Worley. It's a joint venture between an American firm and an Australian firm.
So there is another company in the world capable of doing this work.
That's right. So they went up there, and they actually have done much of the physical work and turned the project, they say, over to the Iraqis so that they can start putting oil through. But even as of, this week, I checked with our folks in Iraq, and oil is still not flowing through that crossing.
Could the Iraqis have built this tunnel themselves?
They probably could not have done the underground version of it. The original version went across a bridge, and they built it. So they could have rebuilt the bridge. They chose to ask the Americans or work with the Americans in doing this underground version, which is more complicated.
Tom in New Bedford, Massachusetts. You're on WNYC. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Brian. Thanks. I wanted to comment on your assertion that surely all the blame for Halliburton's contracts can't be on Cheney, can't be because Cheney was CEO. I read, and I wish I could cite the reference for you, that Halliburton's contracts with the government went up dramatically when Cheney became CEO. In fact, that's why they may have hired him as CEO, so that he could facilitate their contracting with the government.
Oh, yeah, right. I said that you couldn't lay it all at the feet of his becoming vice president. But certainly, why would they hire a former U.S. defense secretary as head of a company that does a lot of military-related contracting? You know, obviously, they wanted to be very connected for political influence, you know, and that was in the 90s. So I'm just saying it's part of the larger pattern of the concerted effort to be politically connected by companies like this, which includes the hiring of Dick Cheney as CEO. James, is that worth expanding on at all?
I'm sort of politically tone-deaf, and I try to be in these pieces because what I do is I go in and try to report the nuts and bolts of what happened in a given project. The political connections, how it all got there, I sort of leave that to other people, and it's in a way it's a good idea to do that because it's sort of a just-the-facts situation.
That's fine. We have about 30 seconds left, I gather. You had a going-away party last night as you're off back to Iraq. What are you going to check out this time?
Right. Well, I want to say good hello to Dan Wakin, who got a painting from me because it was painted by my friend Kate Hammett because he had his thumb broken by me playing football at the going-away party. We sort of made amends and had a great time. And I'll be heading out to Iraq in about a week to begin to do some more of this reporting on the ground.
All right. James Glantz, who we've just learned plays rough, investigative reporter with the New York Times, going back. And it's so hard to report from Iraq these days because it's so dangerous to get around. I hear reporter after reporter tell us that it's just hard to do real journalism because you can't do it safely. So it looks like you're going to do some of the hard stuff. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.